I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon and founder of the Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital in Bangalore, India. The hospital provides cardiac care for the poor in India, and Dr. Shetty started the hospital in 2001. Welcome, Dr. Shetty.
Thank you very much, Jessica.
I'm speaking with you over the phone. You are currently in your home in India. Could you explain in your own words what Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital does?
The idea is to bring cardiac surgery to everyone. My country requires 2.5 million heart surgeries a year. And currently, we are all the heart hospitals in the country put together only doing about 90,000 heart surgeries. Jessica, first heart surgery was done 100 years ago. 100 years later, only 8% of the world's population can afford heart operation. Something has to be done. Narayana Hrudayalaya Heart Hospital has 1,000 beds, and we have 24 operation theaters. The infrastructure is currently performing about 30 major heart surgeries a day, but that is half of our capacity. And about 30% of our workload is on children coming from 65 countries for heart operation. And about 60% to 70% of the work is adult cardiac surgery.
What is the cost of open heart surgery to somebody who could afford it in India?
Approximately a heart operation on a child who can't afford to pay for the operation would cost about $1,400. The same operation in the U.S. might cost you around $200,000.
What are the primary factors in the business model of low-cost heart surgery? How are you managing to provide low-cost care to India's poor population?
First thing is you have to build a hospital differently. If you build a 100-bed, 200-bed hospital, you cannot reduce the cost. Because in a hospital, bulk of the cost goes for a hard infrastructure like blood bank, laboratories, CT scans, MRIs, PET scans. These are very, very expensive instruments. And what we do is we buy all these advanced machines, but we use them for 24 hours. To run it for 24 hours, you need a large number of outpatients. Large number of outpatients will come, provided you are affordable. So first thing is we build hospitals in about 15 to 25 acres of land. And then we plan to build 5,000 beds, which we build in phases. So if you have large number of beds, then you do more operations. As you do more operations, your results get better. As your results get better, your cost also goes down. And because of these two reasons, more people will come to you.
What were you doing prior to opening the hospital?
I graduated from a medical college called Kasturba Medical College in Manipal, Mangalore in India. Then, like most Indian doctors, I went to England for training in cardiac surgery. Then I came back to Calcutta. I was one of the first few heart surgeons to come back to India to set up cardiac surgical unit. It was in 1989 where cardiac surgery was a mystery to most of my citizens. And when I started my career in Calcutta, if I saw 100 patients per day, not even one person could afford the heart operation. Then I realized that unless I take care of the ability to pay or the paying capacity of the patient, I wouldn't have a practice. So this is how everything started.
You conducted surgery on Mother Teresa. How was that a turning point for you, if at all?
Meeting Mother, as a scientist, I would never accept another human being with flesh and blood like me as God. But I can tell you that Mother was truly God in human form. Being with her, interacting with her, maybe as a heart surgeon treating her, it was a turning point in my career. Her simplicity, her approach towards the realities of life, it made a tremendous impact. And she gave me the fantastic definition of the definition for a pediatric cardiac surgeon. One day I was going for rounds and she was following me, even though she was an inpatient. She looked at the kids I operated. Then she looked at my eyes and she said, "Doc, I know why you're here." I said, why, mother, why am I here? He said, when God made these children with the heart disease, he was probably preoccupied. Then he realized there was a problem and he sent you to fix it. And that is the best definition one could give for a pediatric cardiac surgeon.
How religious were you prior to meeting Mother Teresa?
I was always religious, no, undoubtedly. I was born and brought up in a typical Hindu family down south where religion is part of our life. But she reinforced my belief in God. She convinced me that the best way to serve God is by serving mankind. So I still have a poster of Mother Teresa in my office which says, hands which help are better than the lips that pray.
And Narayana Rudayalaya, the name of your hospital, means God's compassionate home.
Essentially, in India, primarily we revolve our life around God and the cosmic forces. We wanted to create something unique, something big, which would make a difference to the society. Rudaya is heart. Alaya is temple.
We talk about Mother Teresa having this seminal impact on you, but was the train on the tracks to create this hospital even prior to your meeting her?
I think I was in the process of thinking about doing something different, something big. And this interaction with Mother, which lasted for close to 5 years, definitely had an impact on where I wanted to reach. Definitely it had a big impact in terms of looking after the underprivileged are the main concern and the pivotal role it had in building this institution.
My guest is the medical entrepreneur, Dr. Devi Shetty. Dr. Shetty is a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. He now provides heart care, eye care, orthopedic care, and cancer care to patients in India who cannot afford health care otherwise. Now, the institution or the hospital is in Bangalore, India, and Bangalore is known as sort of the Silicon Valley of India, where there's a lot of technical innovation. Why did you choose to locate the hospital in Bangalore? Was it accidental or was it purposeful?
My wife is from Bangalore. That is one of the main attractions to come back to Bangalore. But, you know, it's a coincidence that Bangalore happens to be the Silicon Valley and so many exciting developments are happening in Bangalore. That definitely helped our objective. But the decision to come back to Bangalore was coming back home.
You mentioned your wife, and it was your in-laws who funded the project. What did your mother or father-in-law do that enabled them to have enough capital to fund the hospital?
My father-in-law was running a very successful construction company, in fact, around 20 years ago. So towards the end of his professional life, he wanted to build a hospital to make a difference to the society. But he had only one condition, a condition that we should never refuse any child who comes to us with a heart disease, irrespective of caste, creed, and nationality. And this is something which he firmly believed, and he insisted that we do it. That's the only condition he had. And we carried on, and this is how the whole thing started.
It seems, Dr. Shetty, that there was this real kind of perfect intersection of Mother Teresa and your medical expertise and your father-in-law all coming together to create this hospital. Do you ever think about that, kind of the stars aligning?
You're right. I strongly believe in that, Jessica. I strongly believe in cosmic forces. Long, long ago, Jessica, I received a donation of 100,000 rupees from one of the army soldiers from Madras. He refused to give his name, and he wrote one note saying that the path you have chosen, the amount of money I am giving is too small. But God has his own mysterious ways of doing the rest. This is exactly what happened in my life. These are all strange coincidences at every level of my life. But I strongly believe that there is somebody up there with the proper design, which is a mystery to me. Mm-hmm. And that's what keeps happening all the time.
So you decide to launch this initiative in Bangalore. How did you get the land to build this vast health campus?
Our country is made up of 32 states, and these states have chief ministers and the government. And these governments are very supportive of hospital projects by people like us. So we get land virtually free, or we get land for a token amount of money, because government wants this type of large initiatives to come up.
Your hospital is performing roughly 7,000 surgeries a year, and often your doctors are being paid less than doctors elsewhere in the country. How is morale among your doctors?
We have zero attrition rate. No doctor has ever left us. I guess there is not even only one person left in the last 15 years for family reasons. Now, why people stick around, even though their salary is not up to the level what they can get elsewhere, is because as surgeons, if you want to attract them, they need much more than money. They want to do something else. And we always provide what they want, because I am one among them. Every day, children come to us. You know, typically a newborn baby who's very, very blue comes to you. We look at the kid. We tell the mother, baby requires operation. The baby goes to the OT, comes back to the ICU, and we call the mother to see the baby after 4 hours. Mother looks at the baby and say, look, this is not my child. Then we say, that is your child. Then the mother says, look, he was dark. He was black before you did the operation. Then we tell her that, yeah, he was dark, but now he's pink. Then she will touch the baby, and then she will look at our eyes and say, will he always remain like this? Then we say, yeah, he's going to remain like that. So in a matter of 5 hours, we have transformed the lives of these people. So this is something which you can never buy, irrespective of what money, you know, what you're prepared to trade.
You mentioned before that 30% of the surgeries that you conduct in your hospital is for babies or pediatric care. Why is it so high? Is it larger in India than in other countries?
Jessica, you remember, we produce 28 million babies a year. We produce the largest number of babies in the world. One out of 140 children born anywhere in the world has heart disease. That means technically we produce about 600 to 1,000 children a day with heart disease. And someone has to fix their heart, because these children, if they are operated the moment they are born or in the first few months of their life, you can cure them. So someone has to do it. So we are privileged to be that someone to fix these children's heart.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a medical entrepreneur who's creating a new healthcare economic model in India by providing affordable cardiac care for India's poor population. We'll hear more from Dr. Devi Shetty coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is the medical entrepreneur Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. Over 7,000 surgeries take place in his Nayarana Rudayalaya Hospital, located in Bangalore, India. Dr. Shetty founded the hospital in 2001. Now, you offer a form of insurance called Yashasvini. Can you talk a little bit about the germ of the idea for providing insurance?
The Karnataka Milk Federation, which is a conglomeration of milk producers, they requested me to sponsor one of their low-fat milk, claiming that it's good for the heart. And I agreed to endorse their product, provided the Milk Federation agrees to offer health insurance to the people who sell milk. So they agreed to do that. This is how we started the micro health insurance for the farmers who sell milk. And it started with a premium of 11 cents per month. We kept the premium at 11 cents because that is the price of local cigarette called BD they smoke. So the idea was to promote this concept that instead of smoking BD, you buy a health insurance and you will be protected for major illnesses. Today it has grown. This insurance has now spread to other states of the country. Everywhere, 60%, 80% of state population is covered by the health insurance.
So this health insurance that you offer started with this milk cooperative, essentially this group of farmers who, as you say, pay 11 cents a month for insurance. Can you talk a little bit about the rural poor? I mean, your hospital is in Bangalore, in a major city, but how are you addressing the needs of the rural poor who can't be transported to the hospital in time if they're having a heart attack, for example?
First thing is, when they develop heart attack, we look after their heart attack from remote areas, from the satellite. We have, you know, Jessica, there are 5 countries in the world which can put satellite on the space, and India is one of those countries. And we have been chosen to be partners with the Indian Space Research Organization to help them to monitor the astronauts when India eventually puts the man on the moon. And we have satellite connection free of cost. So we put up these satellite collection in remote government hospitals and manage heart attack and heart failure sitting in Bangalore or Calcutta. And till date, we have treated over 53,000 heart patients in remote locations.
Can you walk me through, let's say Devi the farmer is having a heart attack or is having some heart trouble. Can you walk me through what happens to him?
Yeah, let's put it this way. A farmer in Hubli, which is about 300 kilometers from Bangalore, if he develops a heart attack, he will go to a general practitioner with chest pain. And most general practitioners down south has a ECG machine, which is linked to the telephone line. And as soon as he does the ECG, it comes to our hospital. And in less than 5 minutes, we give the report to the telephone line. And if it is diagnosed as heart attack, we ask them to go to a coronary care unit in a government hospital or one of our satellite units over there. So the preliminary care is taken care of. That will save about 95% of the victims of heart attack. And after about 1 month, they will come to Bangalore for further evaluation. And there we do the angiogram and, if required, operation.
You mentioned the Indian Space Research Organization that helps you use satellites for this cardiac care. Whose idea was it to use this space research organization?
The Indian Space Research Organization, they wanted us to help them in monitoring the vitals of astronauts. So we are helping them in their project, and they help us to give the satellite connection free of cost. Right now, sitting in Bangalore, we treat patients in 56 cities of Africa where our satellites are beamed. But the exciting thing, Jessica, I'll tell you, when we do liver transplants on children in Bangalore, do you know who gives the anesthesia for the kids? The anesthesia is given by Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in America.
Wait, so can you explain that to me, how a hospital in Philadelphia is helping you with a liver transplant in Bangalore?
We have extremely skilled surgeons who can do the liver transplant. But our anesthetists are cardiac anesthetists. They do not know the details about managing very sick child who is undergoing a liver transplant, where the operation lasts for 10 hours, 12 hours. So we tied up with Children's Hospital Philadelphia. The anesthetists there, they realized that since we have the satellite link up, they can sit in the operating room of Philadelphia and manage the anesthesia of the kid who's undergoing operation in Bangalore. Other than touching, they can do everything.
So we talk about, Dr. Shetty, you're creating a health city, but it sounds, with this example of the connection with Philadelphia and also serving African patients, that essentially you're creating a health world.
Trying to. Trying to, Jessica.
My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon and founder of the Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital in Bangalore, India. The hospital started off serving cardiac care for India's poor, and now its health centers help patients who have heart problems, eye problems, arthropedic issues, and cancer as well. Could you provide some anecdotes to help us understand what you do on a daily basis?
I start my work very early in the morning. Generally, my colleagues start the surgery at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I reach the hospital by around 7:30. Then I have to see at least 70 to 100 patients every day in the outpatient. That's the time patients come, they talk to me about their problems, I console them, try to organize financial assistance, and essentially it's like a sort of a meeting area for the patients. I spend about 5 hours with the patient. Then around 12 o'clock, I start the surgery, and I generally concentrate on operations called pulmonary endarterectomies or aneurysms. This is my area of interest. And sometimes I operate on newborn babies. Then as soon as I finish the operation, then maybe half an hour or an hour with my team discussing about various strategies and management issues. Then again, the outpatient. And then it's around 9:30, 10 o'clock. That's the time to go home.
You mentioned you see 70 to 100 patients per day in a span of 5 hours?
Yes. I generally try to spend about 2 to 3 minutes with each patient. Everything has been done by my colleagues. The diagnosis is made, the planning was made, everything is done. But most of these people, unless I see them and unless I touch them, they wouldn't like to go for the operation. So it is essentially getting to know the family and explain to them that this is what we are planning to do. It is just reassurance that I am there to help them. I try to see at least in 5 minutes about 2 patients. I have a very big clock hung in front of the wall so that I'm constantly reminded. And I have a very fancy chair made by Herman Miller, which can move from one end of the table to the other end like a ziffy. So I can turn my chair on and off and, you know, facing one patient, and the second minute I'm facing another patient.
Incidentally, was the Herman Miller chair donated?
That's a good question. It is actually gifted by my son. When he graduated, I guess he earned some money, and he was looking at me struggling with the old Indian chair where the wheels used to get stuck up. You see, what happens when I talk to a patient, the first 2 minutes is about talking to the patient, getting to, you know, convincing them about the treatment and all that. Then they are happy with the treatment. Then they start talking about, you know, I operated on their uncle or a father or a grandfather, how well he is or how grateful I am and all that. That's the time I try to move my chair to the other side of the table. And I need very good wheels. And my son realized that Herman Miller is the best chair.
So really what you're giving to these, you know, 100 patients is emotional consultation versus medical consultation.
Perfect. Yeah, you got it right, Jessica.
Do you worry at all that there's this kind of Walmartization of healthcare? In order for your hospital or for your low-cost health plan to work, you really have to serve many, many, many patients. You know, as you say, you're seeing 100 patients a day, you're doing 2 operations a day. This is obviously far more than the international average. Do you ever worry about the optics of that?
Not really. In the sense, see, there are a lot of changes happening in the country. Now, people, when they come to us, they're a lot more knowledgeable about what we are doing in the heart operation. So they have less questions. They're mentally prepared when they come. And also, my team is growing. So I'm surrounded by physician assistants and well-trained doctors. So essentially, I wouldn't say that as the workload goes up, we lose touch with the patients and the emotional aspect of it. I don't think it will happen. I think it's only getting better as the time passed by.
You talk about being at work around 7 in the morning and going home around 10 at night. What does your wife think about this?
She was finding it. She comes from a very rich family. So, she was initially a bit disappointed. But then, you know, as the family grew, now my children are grown up. My oldest son is an engineer. He's building all the hospitals. And my second son is a doctor. Third son is in the medical school. She kind of likes my profession, even though she doesn't admit. All along, she cursed my profession. But when my oldest son decided to become an engineer, and one day he declared that, "Daddy, I want to become an engineer," I said, "All right, that's good." Then she just the hell broke loose. And I said, what happened? She said, why he doesn't want to become a doctor? Then I said, all along you have been cursing my profession, and you're disappointed your son doesn't want to become a doctor. That's the time I realized maybe my wife likes my profession.
My guest is the medical entrepreneur, Dr. Devi Shetty. Dr. Shetty is a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. He now provides heart care, eye care, orthopedic care, and cancer care to patients in India who cannot afford health care otherwise. Dr. Shetty, your public health initiative has been quite successful against many odds. Could you talk about some of those odds or hurdles that you had to jump over in order to provide low-cost health care to the poor population in India?
When I started my career, the greatest difficulty was convincing people to undergo the operation. The heart surgery was in an infantile stage. Then, once I accomplished it, the problem was the affordability.
You have this vision of having 30,000 beds in your health center. What are the hurdles to making that happen? Are they financial? Are they getting people's imaginations to understand what that means? What are those hurdles?
See, the first thing is we strongly believe that India will become the first country in the world to dissociate healthcare from affluence, healthcare from your bank balance. If there is one country in the world which can do it, that is India, because we produce the largest number of doctors, nurses, and medical technicians in the world. We have the largest number of US FDA-approved drug manufacturing units outside USA. We have everything required for a fantastic healthcare delivery system. But there is something which can prevent this from happening, that is lack of adequate beds. That is the reason why we want to create these 30,000 beds. Our biggest stumbling block now is arranging funds at our terms to roll out this many beds in a short duration of time without really losing control of the organization. This has been the challenge, because regular financial mechanisms will not be able to help us. So the challenge is raising equity, raising money for all this massive scale expansion.
What is your annual budget?
I guess around $100 to $120 million.
Per year. Yeah. It costs about $200,000 for a patient in the United States to have open heart surgery. And you are building a center or a hospital, a cardiac care center, in the Cayman Islands so that United States citizens and those nearby could benefit from low-cost surgery. Why does it cost $200,000 in the U.S.?
I think in the U.S., the cost structure is radically different. You see, we work for 6 days in a week, whereas in the U.S., it's only 5 days in a week. Plus, your nurses and doctors generally work for 48 hours in a week, whereas we work virtually double the number of hours. So in U.S. hospitals, traditionally, 65% of the revenue goes for the salaries, while in Indian hospitals, it's about 20%. So essentially, the cost structure, the litigation, the malpractice suits, these are all issues which would jack up the price. And also, there is large insurance companies, you know, with their own, agenda. So essentially, it is a business where there are too many people with too many rigid rules and regulations, and there is absolutely no scope for innovation in the process of delivery. You just cannot innovate.
Hopefully, now that you'll be setting up a center in the Cayman Islands, some competition will cause the U.S. to get their butts in gear.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't think I would like to compete with the American hospitals. I just want to show our modest way of doing things.
You mentioned malpractice and lawsuits in the United States. How common are medical malpractice lawsuits in India?
It's extremely, extremely small. Primarily because as surgeons, we spend a lot of time with the patients before operation. We make things very clear to the family. So they don't have unrealistic expectations.
Doctor, you've changed so many people's lives. You've improved so many people's lives by providing low-cost cardiac care. Is there a story or two that come to your mind to demonstrate this?
See, essentially, I am like anybody else in the patient community, because as a kid, I am the eighth child of a family with nine children. So when I grew up, my parents were old. My vivid memories about my father is an elderly person who goes in and out of the hospital because of diabetes complications. So in my life, doctors remained as very important people, and this may be one of the reasons why I decided to become a doctor. So when I interact with the patients, when I see a young lady with a young husband undergoing heart operation with young children, when I operate on them, I think about my life. In case my father had an operation, needed an operation when he was young, and if something happened to him, we would all be on the street. So, you know, these patients' lives are no different than our life. I guess this is one of the greatest motivating factors for all of us to do our best to save their life.
Well, Dr. Shetty, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica. It was a great experience talking to you, because you are the first Western interviewer who could pronounce the name of my hospital.
My guest has been Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. Prior to launching the company in February 2012, Peter was a Tony Award-winning theater producer. Welcome.
Great to be here.
What percent of the population is under 5'8"?
25% of American men.
So why hasn't a company like this existed prior? You know, you see a bunch of fashion designers actually who are 5'8 or under, like Giorgio Armani, Mickey Drexler, J. Crew.
I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, it's an enormous demographic. It's incredibly difficult to get dressed and find clothes that work. I think maybe it's because this consumer just didn't pipe up and say, what about me? You know, they manage, they go to the tailor, and it's dispiriting and no fun, but, you know, no one's walking around naked. I also think people thought, how do you do it? There's a stigma. And people have tried. I was speaking to a customer the other day who said, oh, we're so glad you're doing this. My husband's she's so happy and all that. And she said, there used to be a store in Washington that closed. And I said, oh, really? I don't know. But what store was that? She said, oh, it was called the Short Men's Shop. And I was like, wonder why that closed. You know what I mean? I just don't think there's the way to do it. And I'm trying to do it in a new way.
Your company doesn't mention the word short anywhere. Is that a conscious decision?
Definitely. It is a stigma. It is a bummer in the world we live in. So why not sort of avoid it? I'm 5'8". I was having problems. I thought if I'm having, you know, issues, then definitely guys shorter will. You know, one of the funny things is men who are shorter, sometimes I'll tell them that I'm doing this. And they go, oh, really? Yeah, that sounds interesting. You know, I do okay. And they'll sort of walk away. And then they'll come back and say, hey, you gonna do polo shirts?
What is so painful about making your pants a little shorter? What does it mean to have a company geared towards the 5'8 and under crowd? Is it just simply making shorter pants?
I don't think men want to shop. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to shop and then have to go for the second step of taking your clothes to the tailor. And also the proportion on things are wrong. So if you get pants shortened, they're still too wide at the ankle and they're too wide at the knee, and it makes you look shorter because your pants are too wide. So it's never quite right.
I heard that you wore a Brooks Brothers boys blazer for several years.
Yeah, you know, it's all true. I mean, men have had to, like, shop in the boys department.
What is a tailor tax?
I call the tailor tax the money, the extra money one pays to fix your clothes. You know, I've shortened T-shirts that are just too long, or polo shirts that are too long, or I've had to take sleeves in because they're just too wide. I mean, it's really a pain. Mm-hmm. If you care, mm-hmm. it's a pain, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of money. And if you don't care, you don't look good.
I noticed you talk about your clothes being inspired by, you know, New York City street life, like the subways, for example. What is it about the subway that inspired your design?
Well, it was about color. The mosaics in the subway, the subway signs, are these beautiful signs from when the subways were first made. Burnished reds and deep blues and kind of great sort of hunter green jewel tones. And, you know, there's a stop at 86th Street and a stop at Bleecker Street I call Bleecker Blue, you know, in my head, you know. So it's that kind of influence.
Now, you're still in the early days of the company. I mean, you launched in February 2012.
Oh, yeah, we're early.
So you're going through the process of defining and executing. And what has been harder for you than you thought, even not very far into the company?
Hard is getting your product made and done. And, you know, in factories that you're, you know, I'm a little pisher. I'm not a big gun yet. So you're not a priority, and how to make sure that you get the quality that you want, that's really a struggle.
The name of the company is eponymous, is Peter Manning. How did you ultimately come to that? Was it obvious, or?
I was talking to a branding firm that was helping me, and I came in into a meeting, and they said, your name is Peter Manning. People would pay us lots of money to come up with that name, and it's yours. In the early days, and still, I'll respond to a customer and they'll say, wow, it's you. And I'm like, sure, yeah, we all pick up the phone around here. There's no, you know, we all are helping. It's all hands on deck. So I think having someone behind it who's felt their pain and who wants the same clothes too is really makes a difference.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the clothing designer, Peter Manning. Peter is the founder of Peter Manning, an e-commerce clothing company for men 5'8 and under. You've had quite a career shift. Prior to starting Peter Manning, you worked in theater for over 15 years.
Yeah.
What drew you to theater initially?
I did start in the theater. I wanted to be an actor. But I loved it. I mean, growing up, I always did it, and I loved it. And then it got hard, and I wanted to see what the other side was about, because I didn't want to just sit around and complain about how, oh, there's no opportunities for actors and they don't really want me and all this stuff. I didn't like sitting around talking actor talk. And I got an internship at Manhattan Theater Club, and I worked there for 2.5 years and ended up saying, oh, producing. Mm-hmm. There's plays, and there's this whole other side of it that I hadn't thought about.
You won a Tony Award in 1998 for Sideman, which was a show that you took to Broadway. A sideman is somebody who plays like in a jazz band, right? How would you just define what a sideman is?
A sideman is a guy who plays in a jazz band. He's a guy who plays for hire, you know, mm-hmm. so he can play in a big band there. He can play at a wedding. He can play, you know, he can play in an orchestra pit. He's a journeyman musician.
Yeah.
And it was a play that I loved that I'd done at New York Stage and Film. When I left New York Stage and Film, I told the writer, Warren Light, I promised him that I would do the play in New York. I had no idea how I was going to do that. And every producer in New York had seen Sideman and turned it down. I knew that it would be a success. I just knew it in my bones.
How much of your memory does that project consume in your era of theater?
It was an incredible, incredible experience for so many of us. And part of it, just as we were moving from downtown to Broadway, our daughter was born. So it's sort of tied up in that as well. But Frank Wood, who played the father, was this journeyman actor who'd sort of been like a sideman, but an actor, because actors are like sidemen too. And he went on to win the Tony Award. Edie Falco played the mother before. I remember Edie Falco telling me at some rehearsal one day, going, oh, yeah, I got the show. It's The Sopranos. I remember vividly thinking to myself, wow, God, Edie sure doesn't seem like the sort of taffeta dress singing type. Because I thought it was, I had no idea. I mean, so we were all kind of young and doing this thing we just believed in with all our heart. Mm. And it kind of, you know, you have this experience where you sort of put it together with tape and love and, you know, hope for the best. And everyone's working for nothing in conditions that are like you know, almost tawdry, and you sort of do it and get it on, and it works. And it just, I knew, and then moved to Broadway and then wins the Tony Award. It just, I thought, that's not going to happen again. So, you know what? Let me just put that Tony Award on my shelf and gaze at that and go home and take care of my kid, was sort of how it went.
Why did you make a shift from theater?
The easy answer and the quick one is that we had a child. And Andre, my husband, now husband, partner then, but now we're married, was the artistic director of Lincoln Center Theater. And I just thought there was no way for both of us to have really the careers that you need to have in the theater, because you have to give 110% in theater. There's no other way to do it half.
How did you meet Andre?
I interviewed to be his assistant. And we had an incredible interview that where we both were like, wow, something was happening here. But, you know, it was work, so we were, nothing did. And I didn't get the job because his assistant didn't end up leaving. But he left a message on the machine saying, well, there is no job, but let's get together for dinner sometime. And I thought, oh, wow, he must have felt it too.
And then you worked at Lincoln Center after.
I did, and that was a little tough. It was sort of exciting at first because no one knew about our relationship, and then it got annoying and hard after a while. That office romance stuff.
You're not the first.
Yeah, exactly.
You and Andre have been partners, and now he's your husband since when? Since
1991.
And you two have had kind of a personal entrepreneurial moment in having your daughter. Can you explain that?
We wanted a child, and, you know, so we sort of stumbled on an agency that was on 46th Street, and we did. But we also, when I look back, I think, wow, we kind of were out there on it. I think we're the first male couple in New York to adopt jointly.
And we take it for granted now because you have a lot of single-sex couples adopting, but you were the first.
Yeah, there are no – Katie has very few peers, and we're in New York. You know, we were always kind of the only two dads around for a long time. Now there's lots of them, which is great. Mm-hmm. But she's a real trailblazer too. So she's got to sort of blaze that trail too and explain all the time as well.
After you left the theater world, before starting the company, you went back to college because you hadn't finished college. You only had a semester left, but you actually went to 4 years at Columbia.
I did. And
focused on architecture.
Right.
So was the thought that you would go into a career in architecture?
Well, I kind of knew that I wasn't going to go into a career in architecture, but I knew that I wanted to finish this degree that was unfinished, and I knew that I loved architecture, and I didn't quite know where it would go. When I got out, a friend who'd been incredibly successful in real estate said, I think you'd make a good developer. And I said, really? What's that? And he said, well, let's go find something and let's do a project together.
It's in Nolita, which is on the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
On Elizabeth Street.
Yeah, it's a building that people can't believe is new. Mm. It's brick and wood windows, and has a kind of detail and kind of heft that buildings used to have 100 years ago.
So why from theater to architecture to clothing? How did you land here?
I landed here because I did the development. It was the same. I was using the same exact skills in my developing the building that I was using in the theater. And I thought to myself, oh, I could do that clothing company that I've wanted to do literally since I was 10 years old. You know, there's a story. My mother, I was 10. We were driving the car in Larchmont, New York, where I grew up. And I said, Mom, I want bell bottoms. And she said, oh, sweetie, I can't buy you bell bottoms because by the time I shorten them, they won't be bell bottoms anymore. Mm-hmm. And I remembered it vividly as, you know, yesterday. And I thought, that's really not fair. It's like the proverbial bell bottoms is my rosebud. You know what I mean? So that's what I've been searching for.
Your earliest memories associated with knowing that you were gay also tie into a sartorial moment, a connection to clothes when you were a child.
Right. I have this vivid memory of my going up the third floor stairs with my older sister, who's, I guess, 9 years older than me, and saying to her, you know what I love? I love waking up in the morning because I can't wait to get dressed. And I have this mustard pair of, like, you know, sort of pants that I loved. I remember my sister having a face on that was like, that's weird. You know, other 5-year-olds are not saying that. And that doesn't mean you're gay, but I mean, it was, so I kind of always knew. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hid it and like lots of people did and came out when I was 21 and everyone I knew was like, oh, really?
You had this love of style and clothes, you know, from the age of 5. How about your parents?
My mother was really, you know, she dressed beautifully. you know, she knew that girl, you know, she taught at a girls' school and she knew girls were watching, so she would pride herself on not wearing the same thing twice for, you know, weeks and weeks on times. She always looked put together and always managed to, you know, look great on without a lot of dough.
And why didn't you start this earlier?
I don't know. It didn't occur to me that I could. I mean, at the time, our building did very well, but the real estate market at the time had just dried up. And so I was sort of trying to figure out what was next. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and start this. And it's like this that thing, and that can happen. I sat next to someone at a dinner party who had a very successful career with the retail. And I told her, I've always had this idea. And she said, that's a great idea. Hmm. Call these people. They are starting a like kind of consulting firm for new brands, and you should really do that. That's a great idea. Hmm. And so off I went.
When you initially launched Peter Manning, where did the capital come from?
I was able to get a loan, $200,000. It was the first time the bank ever gave a loan to a startup.
Hmm. What bank?
M&T Bank, mm-hmm. Because they believed in it. And so that's how I got started, because I was really at the moment where I was like, I can't, maybe I'm not going to pull it off. Maybe I'm not going to get there. And they approved the loan, and I was like, we're off. Hmm. We can do this. But then it's like, well, now you have to go raise more money. But now we have a proven concept and sort of real growth, and people can go, oh, wow, you really are onto something. When you're an entrepreneur, which I guess I am, I'm like the reluctant entrepreneur, sometimes you're so far out on a limb that you feel like it's going to break. You know, I've cried on street corners. Like, I don't know how I'm going to solve this. And then I remember that we're not curing cancer. We're just trying to sell some pants. Like, and you get through it, and everyone's going to live. And it, you know what I mean? When you feel so much and you want so much the right thing, you know.
Why have you cried on a street corner?
Okay, here's what. Chinos are a big part of our business. The chinos that came in right before we were to put them on sale came, and their back pockets were too shallow. Like, you couldn't get a wallet in them, all of them. So we had to send them back to the factory, and then they have to remake them. And they're like, ooh, sorry. I'm like, oh, sorry? Hmm. What? Didn't anyone ask? Like, these pockets don't seem right. Like, no one asked that question? And so I'm still waiting for those pants. They're currently in customs. I'm waiting for them to come. And so it's just brutal. I feel so deeply about my customer that it drives me crazy.
Your daughter, what role, if any, has she played in the founding of this company?
Well, it's funny you should ask. The New York Times did an article about me and the company in March of 2012. And at that time, she's in boarding school now, which she's an ice hockey player, and she'd gotten into the school, and we were going up for what is called the revisit, the weekend where you go and sort of go look at the school and decide whether you really want to go there or not. And that was the day that the New York Times article came out. Like, the New York Times article came out that morning, and we were in the car on our way 4.5 hours to New Hampshire for 2 days, and there was nothing I could do. And my BlackBerry is going, ping, 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 ping. And I'm thinking, I can't go to this school and, like, be one of those New York dads with my BlackBerry in the corner when everyone else is trying to, like, look like, oh, yes, we love it here and the trees are so pretty and, oh, so interested in this humanities class and, wow, the gym's great and the whole thing. And my BlackBerry is literally going to explode from, you know, orders that I'm getting. So I just said to Katie, I said, young lady, when you get home, you are going to work. And we came home, and it was all in our house. Like, one day, a truck came and delivered all these boxes, and I lugged it upstairs.
In Manhattan.
And she, for 2 days straight, for 12 hours, just like pushing it out. We'd push them out. I'd run to FedEx and drop them off. I mean, it was absolute insanity. I mean, a great lesson for a kid to sort of go, wow, this is how it works. You know, and I can see, too, sometimes when she's like, you know, the business, and it's like the other sibling.
It's competitive.
Yeah.
Do you ever see people on the street wearing your clothes?
I have, and it's so great. Just, you know, guy in a shirt and a khakis, and I just, you know, was driving, going by in a cab, and there he was, and I was like, there he is, he looks great. There's a very funny story. My daughter calls one day, and she's like, you're not going to believe it. This guy came up to me at school and said, hey, is your dad Peter Manning? And she said, yeah. And she's like, why? And she said, I wear his pants. It turns out she has a crush on him. So, you know what I mean? The whole thing is too weird, but very funny.
It struck me that, you know, here you are the producer of Sidemen, and Sidemen being musicians in jazz bands, and your career has been somewhat of a jazz song, you know, kind of ad hoc a little bit, you know, going from, you know, this beat to that.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that?
I had never made that connection, but it does make a lot of sense, and it's true. You know, in jazz, I sort of pick up the melody wherever it comes from, and in Sideman, there's a monologue where he talks about his father playing, and he said, you know, he'd be playing the horn, and if a car horn blew outside, he'd incorporate that into his solo. And I guess there's a little bit of that in my life, sort of here are these things, and you're sort of allowing them to give them life, you know, from a play to a kid to a clothing company to a building.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
My guest has been Peter Manning, the founder of the clothing company, Peter Manning. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.